Okay, welcome to section four. That was a meaty lecture, perhaps, somewhat fast at the end, just so that we could give you a teaser of those examples. I'm happy in this more casual environment to actually walk through attribute converters 1, 2, and 3 more so, if you'd like. Perhaps we should begin with any questions, though, that came out of tonight or before?
Just a quick question.
Sure.
On type checker?
On type checker? Okay. When I tested for attributes.
You said when you basically union myself with my parents.
With my parents' attributes.
Right.
Yes.
Myself union with my parents equals my parents, then an attribute.
If the size of that set is equal to the size of the other set, I'm an attribute. No, if you're an attribute, it would be equal to, because in line 32, what you're doing is, on the right-hand side of the bar, you're saying, get the node set that is my parents' attributes. So if I'm an attribute, I'm going to be among those guys. So maybe there's 3 attributes. Well, if I then union myself in, if I'm already there, you can't have duplicates in a set by definition. So a mathematical set doesn't have duplicates. So if you union in yourself with a set that already has yourself, the size of the resulting set is this unchanged. So that's why you get the equality.
I'm already included in that.
Exactly.
Okay. Maybe can you comment on variable scope and lifetimes? I know that they're immutable.
Sure. So a comment on the variable scope and lifetime. Essentially, it follows the rules of most languages where they're scoped to, in this case, not the most recently enclosing squiggly brackets, but the most recently enclosing element. So the most recently enclosing open tag and closed tag. And so as soon as you exit that scope, you no longer have access to it.
And it goes away?
Goes away, yeah. It's pushed onto the stack. Good question. Another question? Sure.
In line 29 and other lines of attribute converter 1.
Okay.
This is the construct name equals
line 2.
Curly brace name function and curly brace.
Yes, line.
That syntax.
Okay, so we're looking at attribute converter 1, line 29. Question is, what's the syntax all about? So line 29 is only executed if, first of all, in line 28, we detect that we are a PI. Processing instructions, recall from lecture 2, have only a name and a value. The name is what follows the question mark at the start of a PI. The value is, we said, everything else. Even if it looks like a PI has attributes, values, they are all clumped together as one value. So what this is saying is, in line 29, attribute converter is about converting the document, not throwing information away. So if we have PIs in the input document, we want them to be in the output document. Project 1, in fairness, let you simplify the world. Project 1, I don't think we required that you retain all such data, rather that you just do the conversion. But in this case, what we do in line 29 is preserve PIs by simply re-outputting them. So if I am a PI, I have a name and a value. So I say, create here a new processing instruction whose name is whatever my current node, whatever my name is, and then give it a value of dot, which is my value, which in the case of a PI is whatever the value of the PI is.
My question was, why isn't it just name, why
isn't it
curly braces?
Oh, okay. So the question is, why do you need the curly braces here? If the reason for that is that we are now they are in quotes, but I think I'll double check this, but the reason they're in quotes here is normally whenever we've used XPath functions like this, we've been in the context of a select attribute. Here, though, we're within an arbitrary quoted attribute value, in which case, and I'll double check that this is in fact correct, we do need to use the attribute value template syntax because it's not implied that you should select the value of this function. You actually have to do the resolution of it and then return that result as the value to put in these quotes.
Okay, so it's the attribute value
implication. Right, right. And so the distinction is, most of the time when you've seen these XPath functions before, to be clear, it's been in the context of select, not in the context of other arbitrary attributes, values. And that's why they're called attribute value templates.
So where can you use those? Is it in any text or any attribute value within a style sheet?
Whenever there is a context node to which it pertains. So in this case, name is being applied to the current node in question, which is whatever was induced by the line farther above, which was, say, in line 17 when we began our iteration. Because we have a context node, yes, we can here at this point in the document say squiggly print out whatever value is relevant to that node. So in short, you almost always see these inside of quoted values, as in the case down here in line 29. And it's any time you want to get data out of your current context.
And what do you need to do if you actually want just curlies and something like that?
If you wanted to get actual curly braces, you know what? You could. I don't believe there's a distinction between the single and double quotes made here. How do you output the literal curly brace? You know, well, you can definitely use that, but I'm just trying to think of the cleanest way. Let me think on that. There are a few different, I mean, you could use an entity, but that's sloppy. Let me think. I don't think I've ever had to even do that. And it's a simple, good question. I'll come back to that. Just make a note to myself here. Okay. Other questions, though? Yeah?
It seems like you don't want to go over this, so you can blow me off into a bad question. But at the top of all these things, there's this style sheet version, XMLS, and then there's a website. The website's bothering me. I don't understand what that's all about.
So I kind of still want to punt on that question just until next week, only because that's what one of our focuses will be. The short of it, though, is that looks like a URL.
Yeah.
It's not technically a URL. It is a arbitrary string that defines the namespace that's used by, in this case, XSL.
So you don't have to be connected to a network to run this thing.
No. Though I've realized Stylus seems to prefer it, for one, since it likes to do its activation thing online, but that's unrelated. No, it looks like a URL. Common point of confusion, it is simply meant to be a unique string, and using URLs is typically a nice way to choose unique strings, because if you own the domain, who else is going to choose that string? So, weird but true. But more time on that next week, if I may. Yeah.
I was still confused about something from the lecture where you had two templates, one of which matched, forget the exact map, but just off with slash database slash something slash some name.
Okay.
And the other one matched just the name.
Okay.
And you said that for the template, it doesn't matter how you got to a node as far as whether the template matches.
So I think that what you're referring to was when we had a template that matched just title, and then we had another template that matched slash database slash movie slash title. And I think perhaps I should just say ignore whatever the guy over there said and distinguish these two as follows. When it comes time for a title element to be processed in your document, the processor will check if that title element more closely matches this or more closely matches this match structure. So this is not to say, if it matches this path, this is a more precise path than just this one, so this template is the one that will be invoked, the more explicit one. If, however, this is the title of Sir Anthony Hopkins in an actor element, this one's not even relevant, so this one will be applied. But the point I was trying to make, and I think an answer to your question at one point during lecture, was this does not imply, this second, more verbose template, slash database, slash movie, slash title, does not say start matching at the root and dive down into database, movies, movie, title, because this is a template match. This is not a pull invocation as like a for each might or a variable definition might be. And that's what I mean to say, and if I said something else, that's hopefully the better explanation.
No, that's fine.
Okay.
It's not obvious to me why, if you're applying templates to some title, to a title element,
okay,
it's not obvious to me why that first template should necessarily match it. Because that match equals title looks to me like a single step along the child axis to a title element.
No, here, for simplicity, assume here that for the matching, don't think of it for now so much as being access-based matches. What you're looking at is simply an element called title. So ignore the context. The context is, in effect, external to this template's definition. And even that's kind of a white lie, but I think the simplest way to think about it for now, until we spend, I think, even more time on this, is this just means match a title element. And don't worry about the context. That will be checked later. And here, it won't be checked at all. Here, it will be because there's such specificity in the path.
Did you say actor/title?
Yes. Yes, you could say actor/title if that were applicable to the content. Yeah. Yeah. If we did movie title, then if this top one were movie...
Title.
Oh, movies title?
Yeah.
So this doesn't exist anywhere, at least in my Blockbuster.
Not the example that is given, but if it's on the title...
Sure. So, yeah, and actually, let me use the example we discussed earlier, actually, which was if it's actually database actors, actor title. So we have, like, Sir Anthony Hopkins with Sir being the title. Then, really, there's no collision whatsoever. They're totally different.
Yeah. But if there is an occurrence, if there is an element called title within the movie.
Nor is there a collision here, though, because... Well, here too, you don't have collision because, again, when you get to a point in the story where you're saying, okay, here's the title element, what template do I apply? You then check, okay, we've got two possible matches because both of these end in title. So then the processor would, in effect, look previous in the path and say, okay, the current title element, is its parent a movie element or a movies element? And then based on the answer to that, it will choose the appropriate one. You would have a more interesting case if you tried to match in the top one on movie/title and in the bottom database movies movie title, here you have a collision. Oh, yes. Hidden by my cursor. So movie/title now does collide in part with this one. So which one would get invoked when I get to the point in my story where I say, here's a title element, which one applies? The more specific one. So here, too, it's still this one because it's more specific. Yeah. And then John. No, go ahead.
Can you talk about priority? Like, when you brought that in, you went priority.
Okay, so this one, current... Oh, okay. So this has a default priority of 0.0. This one has a higher priority. It's at least 0.5, I think it is. If, however, I don't care about W3C's predefined priorities, I really prefer my top template, maybe even just for the sake of debugging, I could say, you know, it's priority 1,000. And that will totally trump any of the built-in values. And that's all I meant.
Okay.
I would say it's not often where you need to be hard coding your own priorities, because things start to get a little sloppy, I think. John?
The top one where you just have title, is that equivalent to // title?
Yes. But the // is meaningless, because all that's saying is this title element can appear anywhere in the document.
Right, so it's the same.
Yeah, this too is saying anywhere in the document.
Specificity could be vague. I'm just thinking if the top 117 title said movie, and the bottom one said movie title.
And the bottom one said, okay, so if the top one said movie, and the bottom one said movie title.
Yeah.
No collision whatsoever. Because, so, and this is the only time where I actually think, only because I think I told it so well. The story that we spent probably 10 minutes on in lecture tonight, where I really laboriously walked us through the story of, okay, you start by matching the root. Then you call apply templates on the children. That's the story you have to bear in mind, because you tell that story and then you ask yourself on each iteration questions, okay, here is a title element. Which template do I apply? Now you check. So because those questions are always phrased in the form, what template do I apply to this element? There's no contention here, because it's either going to be a movie element or title element. It can't be both. Yeah. Slide 13. Okay, so slide 13 from lecture 5. Was the one titled Built-in Templates.
I'm just confused about the middle one.
Okay.
Where it says match text, the attribute star.
Okay.
I'm just confused about why is the attribute star there if nothing happens? Nothing really seems to happen.
Ah, it's a good question. So this middle template on slide 13 is effectively telling us that the default behavior for attributes is to print out their value. The problem, or at least the reason in our demonstration, that by default, if you just recursively descend through your document printing the value of everything, attributes don't get selected, is because of this line in the first built-in template. Recall that in our original slide, in your printout, it doesn't say this, but that's implied, we said. That's the default value, is a select of child :: star. Well, what is the principal node type when you're on the child axis? Elements. Nowhere else in the built-in templates do you have an apply template, so nowhere else is recursion induced. So if this is the only place recursion is induced, and by definition it's only induced on child elements, you never actually apply the templates to the attributes. So you have built-in behavior for them, but you don't have built-in application of them. Oh, because it's useful. Because if I, as a developer, implement some style sheet or template that actually says select attribute :: star, I'd like there to be default behavior of that. If I say select the value of attribute :: href, I want that href attribute's value to be printed like this. I don't want to have to implement this myself. Sorry, yeah, not value of, apply templates. In short, these built-in templates, the first one jump-starts the whole recursive process, which is useful. The second two just provide you with default behavior for anything for which it makes sense to print a value, and that's useful because you, the developer, shouldn't have to, every time you implement support for printing attributes, to paste something like this second one in.
Right, okay.
So it gives you the ability to print, it's just this is not calling that template. This is not applying that template ever.
Okay.
And that's the distinction. It's useful for not built-in templates, for your own templates.
Okay.
Good question. Yeah, John.
The top one, that only gets called if you don't have a template match slash yourself.
Or an element, yes. The star means if you don't have a template for a foo element and one is encountered, use this one. So recall our demo that you incited, actually, when we had an overridden behavior for movie elements, but we did not override initially the behavior of actor elements or actors elements. And that's why we got just a value dump of all of the actors' names. And that's because actors, at that early point in our story, didn't have a template defined for it, so the built-in one applied, the one that matches star, and that guy recursively applies templates to all of its children. Eventually you bottom out with text nodes for which the default behavior is to print them. And do realize this does take a while to sink in, and this slide, usually these canonical slides are sort of the more boring ones that you can wave your hands at, but this kind of is the definition of XSLT, certainly in the push sense. It really explains why everything works the way it does. Okay.
You have just another child element of database. Would you have to would that default built-in template occur on that third?
Yeah, so that was what I was hinting at when I verbally said, suppose my Blockbuster had also a child of the database element called genres and movie studios, and you had a whole bunch of other metadata that if you want to hone in on the movie elements, you'd have to then override the behavior of not only the actors element, as we did in example 3, but also the genres elements and so forth. So I think the solution we came up with in version 3 or 4 was in stylus to actually override everything at the start and match on the root, and then inside of the root, then we explicitly said XSL apply templates not on select equals child :: star, but rather explicitly on database, movies, movie, and that short-circuited from the top down what would have been a recursively invoked process from the built-in templates. In other words, if you set up your main your root template to match the root and then apply templates not on all the children as the built-in one does, but explicitly just on these, then you don't have that problem. Because nowhere are you applying templates to genres or actors or anything else. They're only being applied explicitly to this.
So when you say apply templates there, that's calling the default template for the element movie?
It's calling whatever template exists for movie, which in this case will be only the built-in one, because I've got nothing else on the board. Yes.
And so you would have had to have a template that matched. If you wrote your own template that matched exactly that, database movies movie.
Sure, or I can actually, I can be a little lazy because I know the structure of the document and just match on movie now, because I know the document, contains no other such movie elements. And here I could just say, okay, you know what, just print out the XSL value of the title child and then a BR. I'm going to correct your terminology again. Apply templates induces the application of this template to these nodes. In effect, it's what you said is true, but technically what I said is correct, though the effect is the same. Okay.
Can you also have another apply template right underneath
that? Oh, sure. You can have as many apply templates as you want. So we could, for instance, say, write in my template match, quote-unquote, root, or slash, here are movies. And then below that, I could say, here are actors. And then below here, I could say, XSL, apply templates to database, /actors/actor. And in fact, I wouldn't even need to now implement the template for actor, because if I just want to print out their names, I'd have to add a BR in there. Actually, I would need to put this thing, because if I want the BR, I would need to define another. But absolutely, just apply templates means now go apply templates to these nodes, maybe these nodes. Totally up to you. But it's the simplicity of this canonical form that's nonetheless so powerful. How much you get out of just these built-in templates. It's pretty neat. Yeah, John?
In titles 2.xsl,
Okay, titles2.xsl.
I didn't follow how, I understand the first part where you're printing out node 1 titles, so you're printing out the first title, but I don't understand on line 20 how nodes.
Okay.
Again, I don't understand that. I don't understand line 20.
So, but you don't understand why it's, what was the last word? Okay, it doesn't, is the short answer. Line 16 prints out the title of the first node in the node set. Line 19, lines 18, 19, 20, say call print titles again, recursively, but this time pass in a node set that includes the same node set except the first element in it. So elements 2 through N. Position returns the current position of the node. So recall from last week how predicates function. So $nodes is a node set. So node sets have some document order. So this filter is applied, like we said last week, to each of the nodes in turn. And that predicate decides, does this node stay in or does this node get filtered out? So in effect, you call position on each of those nodes in turn. And if the current position is greater than 1, you keep it in the node set. Which means, equivalently, if the current position equals 1, it gets filtered out.
Is $nodes is a variable?
Yep.
And we'll...
The value of which is a current node set, which was passed in earlier.
Okay, so that would include the first one that we processed above.
Oh, yeah. But now we want to exclude it. So we say only keep through this predicate those whose position is greater than 1. Because we already printed.
Okay, so it's going to keep 2 to the end.
Correct. And I can make the
second one to the end. It doesn't have a termination.
It doesn't have what? Oh, yeah, we did. We broke this. So look at your printout. This one will, because of you, recurse. Oh, no, because of the other gentleman who was there in the back, print forever. So, but to make it more explicit, when I print out the value of this, this line here now, 16, if I change it to be $nodes, position equals 1, instead of just bracket 1, hopefully makes more clear the parallelism. But again, refer to your printouts, which is right, we've butchered this now. So before we run out of time, I thought it would be useful if we just do at least a slight more of a verbal walkthrough of the project so that you know what to focus on, what not to, because we got a few questions about why, for instance, FOP was not outputting FO, XSLFO. Well, that's because we haven't even talked about XSLFO yet, so it's correct behavior if your answers are not being PDFified. The project?
Yeah.
I do. That's okay. I have the electronic version. So I will, on this very tiny screen now, look at the... All right, I'll look on the very big screen. It's okay. All right, so we are turning our attention, for those of you tuning in at home, to the Project 2 specification. What we did with Project 1, which I think was helpful, was zip through this with me telling you what questions you can do or should be able to do and which you shouldn't necessarily. So let's flip through. Ah, there we go. So let's see. Number 1, you should do. Number 2, you should do. And stop me if I'm going too fast. But perhaps a useful scheme would be to circle the ones you can do or whatever works for you. Okay, number 3, you can do. Number 4, now you can also do. However, realize that the preface to numbers 3 and 4 say to put your answers in a file called questions.xml and then create a style sheet that will ultimately output XSLFO. That part you can wait until after next lecture, but certainly the questions themselves you can answer now, because the content won't be unfamiliar to you. But the PDFification, that's even a verb, will come from next week's discussion of FOP. So no more questions about why you're getting FOP-related errors. It's because you haven't used FOP or XSLFO yet. Okay, number five you can definitely do, and hopefully should be done. But this is really an exercise in just XPath functions. Probably, it's arguably not at all the right way to solve this particular B2B problem, but it's a really good way in a very safe, simple context to start playing with XPath functions, particularly string manipulative ones. Yep, so this 1999, March 12th, etc., is the canonical format described in prose here, so it's fixed width fields, so this is representative. You shouldn't hard code your style sheet, obviously, just to print out this, but you should be able to convert any string like this one. And it's really just a matter of using substring functions or you could even use recursion now by doing something similar if you want to be a little adventurous with what we did with titles2.xsl. You can be clever and recursively call things, passing in a string where it's, what is it, substring after, I think, is the XPath function. You could do something very similar in spirit, not because it's a good way, but because it's a fun way. And for this, do whatever works best for you. It's a sandbox. Yeah.
January through September always has a zero in front of it, for example.
Yep.
01 for January. But days, if the day is less than 10, would it be 01 through 09? Or would it be a single digit?
Nope, it would always be two digits. So I tried in picking this date to pick ones that were representative. It's fixed width. So what you see is what you'll get.
It's always two digits.
Yep. Otherwise, it'd be hard and annoying to do, certainly, with XPath. Okay, question six. You can absolutely do now. Frankly, we've done so much of this already in demonstrations, and you have printouts of it. Arguably, the only tricky part or thought-provoking part, besides just putting it all together, what we've discussed, will be to do the cross-referencing so that when you iterate, for instance, over all of the movies by title, you're able to sort of cross-reference the actors' elements. Because recall that this linkage is done by IDs and actor refs. So realize that you can do something, and I'll say this verbally and type it as well, that this is large enough to see, do it in stylus. So realize that you can do things like this. If you wanted to print out the XSL value of and select the value of a, let's say, database/actors/actor predicate, that is open bracket, whose name or value, so dot suffices, equals, and I'm going to leave it like I did with someone who came up earlier during break, like that. So for those of you playing along at home, you might benefit from syntax like XSL value of select equals quote unquote /database/actor/actor open square bracket dot equals something. In effect, what this is allowing you to do, if your current context is a movie element, is cross-reference probably the, what is it called, the actor ref child with some other location in the document. So because I'm using this absolute path, because I am selecting the absolute path to this actor element, it doesn't even matter if my current context node, as it's called, is in this branch of the tree. Probably my current context node is actually going to be a movie element, but realize that in an XPath expression, when you dive down deeper and deeper and deeper into a location path, your context node becomes whatever came last. So the context node or nodes here are actor nodes, which means when I say dot here, if I'm in a for each iterating over movie elements, dot refers to, guess what? Actor, the most proximal node in question. So if you want to get at what was in your loop, the current node, that is to say, if this XSL value of that I just recited for those of you listening in, if you actually had an XSL for each and you selected something like, I'll just say movie, so that this whole expression, the value of, is actually inside of a for each, notice that now the dot that I referred to refers to who? This guy or this guy? This guy. actor. So how do you get back to referencing this? You use, as you may have seen, an XPath function called current, which just returns the current context node, not relative to your present location path, XPath query, but the current context node. So contrast this. Dot refers to the nearest guy. Current takes you in scope, really, one step higher. If you have now multiple nested loops, for each, in a for each, there's no way of going two levels back. You can only go to the nearest one. So you have to be careful. But in short, the lesson here, and this is wrong, like this is not the answer to the question necessarily, but you want to do some kind of equality, and this is an example of how you might cross-reference a current value with some value that's found in an entirely different branch of the tree. Just remember, your absolute paths.
Would it be less right if instead of using the current function, we do something with like a variable?
No, you could absolutely use a variable, and that might even be more straightforward to you. Sure. But realize, variables, once declared, can't be mutated, so you can't just keep updating it. So it probably wouldn't be workable here, but it might be in other contexts, especially if you're doing like apply templates. But realize that my blockbuster in this question, which is where we left off, number six, it's meant to be relatively simple, but you might bang your head against the wall for a little bit figuring things out, but what you'll find is that the lessons from my blockbuster really will lend themselves to XTube's implementation. And time-wise, again, you are intentionally given 3 weeks for these things, so B2B, frankly, should be done. If it's not, it should be done quickly. My blockbuster should be done quickly, because really you want to start playing around with XTube, because after next week's lecture, you'll be savvy with, or at least familiar with, SVG, and that's really the final part of the project, which is not going to be a lot more work. The most work will be playing with XTube and getting the first HTML-based implementation, and from there should flow the SVG, but you certainly don't want to leave all this till the last week, because it's meant to be incremental, where once you're savvy with this, XTube will be easier, but not so easy that it's doable in the same day. Okay, so I would say this should be done in the next 2 days, 3 days, I think, frankly, for you to feel comfortable moving ahead. Okay, that little scare tactic. Number 7, you should do, because it's 0 points, and it just means reading and familiarizing yourself, so that should already be done. There's a lot of reading, but as I said last week in section, you don't need to be an expert on the OS coordinate system. It's meant to be one sort of a fringe benefit of doing the project, learning a little bit about British geography and how they map things elsewhere in the world. But it also hopefully makes clear what all the crazy numbers in the file are actually referring to. And it's relevant only insofar as you need to scale these kinds of coordinates with respect to a GIF, which is not thousands of miles large. It's only a few thousand pixels wide. And even there, you need to scale things correctly. But the spec walks you through that. So question 9... you can defer until after next week. Oh, yeah, you should do 8, sure. I would say you'd be in great shape if you attend lecture next week, having finished 8. Frankly, it might be a little bit of a lot to bite off, but it should be doable. You do have all the requisite material now, and XTube is a much larger file with much more intricacies that will be much more conquerable once you've done my blockbuster. So 9, you can defer until after next week, unless you're being particularly adventurous. Number 10, you can wait on, but you might want to make notes to yourself as you do number 8, because 10 essentially asks you, we've given you XTube in what's perhaps one of the most efficient ways possible. There really isn't redundancy of data except in maybe one place, which is really a time saver. You will find that there could have been other layouts of this data that would have made your XPath, your XSLT run faster. So we've seen dozens of students do this now, and your XSLT should absolutely not be taking 2 minutes, 3 minutes, 17 minutes, 20 minutes to run. We should be talking seconds. You know, maybe a minute or 2 minutes on a slow machine. But there are ways to use the current data set without changing it, as this question hypothesizes you could do, So realize that if you are arriving next week in lecture really behind because your style sheets take 17 minutes to run and then debug, like, you should debug and then run them. So with that said, number 10 asks you to address why perhaps the file does not lend itself to the most efficient processing. But what you'll find is that in the real world, it might make sense to take some XML input, megabytes as it might be, pre-processes it, maybe double it in size, even though that might have redundant information, because then subsequent processing is much faster. And this just asks you to explore that, but you can't make such changes for your own implementation. And then number 11, you should do on time. All right. Questions? Yeah?
Just to be clear, the result of number 8 should be an XSLP style sheet that makes a single huge XHTML.
Yes. So the output of 8 should be similar in spirit to my blockbuster, but obviously with much more data. And I intentionally don't show you screenshots of what it could look like because it's actually much more fun to see students' different interpretations of that. And we've seen some really neat navigation techniques and visualizations. So have fun with it, frankly. Just be sure to adhere to the spec as worded. But there are many different ways to do it. And using lots of colors and even WAV files, I mean, you can really have fun with it, I think. There's some Easter eggs in the distribution. And the reason for, finally, this big colorful map, it's not because it's required. In fact, the PDFs online might be better because you can search them with Control F, which can help you find stops and see where things are. But it's tough to look at x2.xml and appreciate what the lines look like. So just keeping this on your desk and being able to piece things together and really debug your output to make sure, all right, I can get from Bayswater to Queensway, as my webpage suggests, is a useful thing. So this is sort of a reference to keep in mind. And the back side has all of the tubes and all the trains and trams. Front side has the tube. Whew. I'm about spent with my voice. Any other questions? No? I'll stick around and whisper some answers if you have any more. All right, see you next week.